a production of South Dakota Public Broadcasting.
Thank you for joining us this morning. Just a reminder to everybody in the room, when we have the Q&A portion, to please use the mics at the table, and everyone as well on the phone, to mute your line, press star 6. To unmute, press pound 6. I'm Kelsey Pritchard with the Governor's Office, and if we have anybody on the line who would like a handout on roads that's been distributed this morning, just send me an email and I will send that your way. And with that, I'll turn it over to Lieutenant Governor Matt Michaels.
Thank you. Thank you very much, and appreciate everybody who's here physically and those individuals who are watching this recorded and those listening. And I intend to just talk for a little bit, but enjoy this on behalf of the governor and me more. A Q&A. I think that's much more beneficial for what you're focusing on. I want to take you back, though, to a number of years when the governor and I became friends. He was working for Children's Home Society, which is an organization that takes care of needy children, children who may be neglected or difficult to take care of. We came into the legislature, and way before we were honored to be in leadership, we were working on juvenile justice. And at that time, I'd come out of the service and was a federal prosecutor, and it dealt a great deal with kids' issues. In my city of Yankton, there's obviously quite a few children and some that came from other places for behavioral health services at the Human Services Center. And so I had seen what happens in families and individuals and kids that get in trouble, and was sort of surprised that we incarcerated so many kids. We obviously had had a lot of evolutions and issues over the years, and so 4 years ago, a little more than four, when we came into office, we set a couple of really stretch goals out there, and one of them was, can we look at ways to reduce our prison population? And that's what happened 2 years ago with the Public Safety Improvement Act. Right now, as we sit here today on this Friday, is a long hearing going on as a result of really what has been a dream and a vision of a number of people in this state to deal with the problem that we will always have children in need, children that have issues, children that have a criminal tendency, and those that actually are in environments that result in a chemical dependency problem or a behavioral health issue. And over the last year, juvenile justice has taken a tremendous amount of effort on behalf of many organizations, from law enforcement to other public safety sectors to the unified judicial system. And Jim Seward, who is our general counsel, has been leading that group to come up with a new way to make sure that we're smarter taking care of these kids. We currently incarcerate children in this nation. We are the second highest state in incarcerating children. And that's not because we actually have more violent crime or kids that are committing crime. In fact, those two facts don't connect. In fact, we have lesser violent crime, but we have more status offenders or issues relative to chemical dependency. And taking children out of that environment, putting them into different institutions, has proven to not work. And based on facts, based on individuals who are actually working on that, based on Republicans and Democrats and people from different areas, worked very hard. And today is the way that the people of South Dakota expect us to make transformational change for the good. And it's already proven and resulted in some good outcomes already. And that hearing is going on right now, but it's organizations coming together and convincing the legislators, the people, that this is a way to handle it. And so today is a very significant day as it relates to juvenile justice, and I'll just park that there. But thank everybody who worked on it, and especially all of you who have covered it, because it's an area that a lot of people won't cover. It doesn't affect many people directly, but it does affect our communities, and getting that care and treatment and alternatives closer to home will be beneficial. The second thing that Kelsey had indicated to you at the outset that we thought was very critical in terms of highway funding. It's a very complex area, and it's even more complex for people to understand and for you as the media to be able to communicate that out to your viewership, listenership, and readers. And so that's why we have handed out in this room, and just reiterate what Kelsey said, it's a packet based with some flow charts and some data on the funding proposal so that you can get in. Some of it's fairly in-depth, but we believe that this is information that needs to be out there to be evaluated and digested, and so that you can write on it, but more importantly, ask questions about it, and we can continue to get feedback on that need. And so with that, like I said, uncharacteristically, I'm not going to talk a whole lot. I'm just going to answer your questions. So,
Jackie Severn with Public Radio. Could you maybe outline, if you can, you may not be able to, but maybe the differences between Governor Dugard's highway proposal and the proposals put forth by Senator Valley?
Yes. There is, to some extent, in this packet, some comparisons, so that would help you statistically. But at the outset, it's a little closer to about half of what the summer study put out there. And so it's in the $50 million range in various categories in the way it plays out. I would tell you that one of the areas that was the greatest concern out of the summer study bill was there is a current type of gasoline that actually has a color in it that dyes the gasoline and therefore is not subject to this tax that is used for agricultural machinery. And that was in his bill one that would, that exemption, that is, would require tax to be paid on gasoline then for farm machinery. And so that is not in this bill. It's probably the most controversial piece that was in that bill that we've taken out. There's another element within the legislation that the governor is offering is after the gas tax distribution, after the registration fees, et cetera, that a county and a township would have the ability to ask the people to levy an increase for roads and bridges in that county. So if I'm in Hughes County, there's a certain limit on what be able to do that, and it's referable for people to vote on. And so that's different. There's also a little difference in the way that counties and cities could get the money. They would need to have much more formality in a study and be able to present and essentially say, well, you know, we need money for a bridge. That's one thing, and that would be dismissed in the current environment. But what would happen now is there would have to be a plan. The state puts together a plan, a state transportation improvement plan, that says in Meade County, we're going to be doing this next year. In next year, we're going to be doing this in Pennington County. And next year, we're going to do this in Sully County. And it's all through districts in the state. That's currently not done in many counties. And so that is also something that's required before funding may be asked from the state with the people's money that's being utilized. And so I think those would be the highlights. The rest would be a deep dive that would bore people.
And is this going to be the $50 million? It's an ongoing.
It is.
Yeah, okay. And Senator Mike Valley's is also an ongoing.
That is correct. Yep, they're ongoing. There's the sales, the tax increase on in the governor's bill for gasoline would be 2 cents each year, though, ongoing. And so it would obviously continue because the principle there is the cost of roads increases, and if those funds aren't needed, the legislature in the future then could reduce taxes, which is something legislators have and certainly have would do. So thank you for the questions.
Do we have any questions on the line?
Mr. Lieutenant Governor Tony Mangan at KCCR.
Good afternoon, almost.
You were talking about the county's ability regarding the transportation funding, and you know that they could do that. But and you also mentioned Hughes County, but Hughes County commissioners three times have tried to increase the wheel tax, and have lost badly in referral votes. For those counties like Hughes County, where they may not be able to get the public support, how do you know what else can they do?
Well, And we're going to send you the flow chart, Tony, and thank you for the question, because there actually is, at the outset, about $15 million that would be part of an improvement grant fund. And so if they put a plan together and there is good local effort, and that's another reason why it doesn't say specifically there has to be a wheel tax. It says, you know, what is the local effort? What's their local contribution from property taxes now? So in addition to current local money that they get, counties get a good portion of the registration fees and other aspects of that. And so you'd have to look at what Hughes County, and I apologize, I don't know what that is, Tony, but they'd have to look at what they have now, what their needs are, just like the governor presented statewide, and then be able to make an application for a grant, and that'll be a revolving fund. And in the first year is about $15 million in that. And I think that especially it's difficult to describe that in the radio world, but when you see this, Kelsey will email it to you. I think that therein would lie the answer for your listener and readership.
So basically, there will be a way for the counties to get some of this money.
Yes,
without having to do an approval with the voters.
That's correct. They would get some naturally by the fee increase, sort of like a few years ago, the legislature passed a large tax increase on the price paid for new vehicle purchases. Registration. I'm wrong. It's registration. And that predominantly goes to the county. And so that would be increased. So they'd get an increase from that. And then also they would have this additional fund that they could apply to.
Well, one other quick question for you, Mr. Lieutenant Governor, and that is the governor has issued an executive reorganization, moving some agencies like Historical Society and Cultural Heritage Center back from Department of Tourism back to Department of Education, where it's been in the past. Any particular reason for that reorganization now?
You know, what we thought, it's interesting because, Tony, the Constitution allows the governor every year the legislature comes in to do a reorganization. And we did a massive one 4 years ago, if you recall, in just aligning what we had campaigned on. For example, I'm responsible for military and veterans, and we divided that up so that they're separate departments. Tourism is separate. And Department of Tribal Relations, really top of the mind, big, significant things. We got a conversation about, is there something that you would want to do, even though you could do it every year, coming into your fourth year? And we had a long dialogue about it. In the Historical Society and Library and all of that, it aligned because there's a lot of scanning and archiving going. And so they really are of the same ilk, doing similar jobs, and that they would be synergies working together. So not small for their jobs, but very minor in terms of impact to the governmental operations. Probably the most significant one, Tony, was as an EMT and a former emergency department nurse, I personally was surprised that the Department of Public Safety, which handles law enforcement and fire, had the responsibility for emergency medicine. Makes sense. It's where I got my license. But our whole emergency medicine program and protocol and how we handle regional crises and all that planning is really done through the Department of Health. And so that's also, and I think probably the most significant part of that reorganization order is the Office of actually for EMTs, Emergency Services, is being transferred over to Department of Health to align with health planning and emergency medical services through hospital care. And we already have a multiplicity of programs where you have the various levels of hospitals for various care depending on what region you're in. Thanks for the question, though.
Hey, thank you, Lieutenant Governor. You're not expecting at this point any other reorganizations, am I right?
Negative. That's correct. This is it. And it's pretty minor compared to where we were 4 years ago. So,
thank you very much.
Thank you. Other questions?
Other questions on the line?
Yes, so Lieutenant Governor, it's Todd Epp at KSOO in Sioux Falls. How are you today?
Good, Todd. How are you?
Good. Just looking out the window, we got sunny skies for once.
Oh, it's nice. Probably because Nobi's not there, huh?
Yeah, that's true. Well, he's here today, then he's on vacation for a while.
Okay.
This is kind of more of a philosophical question, and it might be a little long-winded, but I don't feel so bad after listening to Tony's four questions. So
fair with touché, me. Touché.
And Tony, I kid because I love. I've covered legislatures in Kansas and South Dakota since the early 1980s, and one of the things I noticed is that Republican legislators could never go wrong being too hard on crime. Now, all of a sudden, we see a Republican governor and presumably a Republican legislature saying, oops, I guess it didn't work, and so we need to do something else. So is this a change politically for the Republicans, that the get tough on crime A didn't work and B was expensive, and more specifically in South Dakota, the JNCLO approach of being really harsh to juvenile offenders, is that out the door as well? Your thoughts, Mike, Matt?
You know, I am truly grateful for the question, and I take issue with your preface. I don't think it's philosophical. I think it's I'm going to speak for myself and why I think and why I know my thinking has changed. So I was an emergency department nurse, Todd, as you know, and I saw people come in with demons, dying or having other issues with chemical dependency or behavioral health. And I also saw the results of crime, violent crime. When I was a federal prosecutor in the United States Navy, I saw an immense amount of violent crime and things that I don't even want to harken back the memories of because it was so vicious. But I also saw a very large stripe of individuals who, for example, pedophiles that I really believe cannot be cured. But I also saw a lot of individuals, by virtue of what happened when they were young, where they lived, that they ran to chemical dependency issues and just had no structure, didn't have people loving them. And I don't want to get too maudlin about this, Todd, but my mom raised us mostly as a single parent. And I remember, you know, my grandfather said to me when I was first elected to the legislature, he said, I know a lot of people would be surprised that that was the institution you were in the legislature, instead of another one. And it was because you know, we as kids and young people do not very smart things. And I live in that glass house. And for people to not say it and run from that is disingenuous. And I, you know, the politics of it, I certainly understand. And I was part of it, Todd. When I came to the legislature, because of what I had seen in my experience, I introduced legislation that increased maximums and said and wrote to my constituents that I had done this. At the same time, I was finding that was for areas like pedophiles, and tried to discern what is smart. And then when we had the event at Plankinton that you covered, we went through a great deal of what is smarter, what's the science out there, and bringing people together. And overwhelmingly, the people that we have in our system have a combination of issues. And that those criminals that will do us harm, that are evil and soulless, need to be locked up and protect society. But through drug courts and diversions, I mean, essentially as a kid, my mom said, you know, we took some candy from a store downtown, and my mom said I had to go down and tell them that we did that. And we had to clean up the bottles in the back. And it never went to court or anything, but in this day and age, something might. And so there's a lack of uniformity also about this fancy word diversion, but also taking kids out of home. And so I would tell you, yes, absolutely. I think with the evidence that's out there, we've all been doing this based on facts, based on numbers. Heck, Todd, there are some courts that still send a lot of kids off, and there's no rhyme or reason to why they're sending them off, but that we're trying to get our arms around not being softer, but smarter. And that sounds sort of trite, but it really is. When I was in the legislature, we piloted a program called Intensive Juvenile Probation, and it came as a result of the boot camp aspect that I fought very hard for keeping intensive probation for kids and serving their families. And we're currently doing a pilot in Yankton called Family Functional Therapy that's keeping the kids in school, making sure that, they're getting their counseling programs and meeting with probation or court services officers. So in a nutshell, I would say, as Winston Churchill said when he was interviewed, and he had articulated a position that was different than a few years earlier, he said, you know, I've changed my opinions because I've got newer facts. What do you do? And I think that that's where we are as a society. And also, I think, Todd, as we get older and we talk with folks, we just understand how ubiquitous the issues are relative to family instability and relative to chemical dependency capabilities, and that taking care of these issues closer to home is the smarter way to do it. Now, there are kids that need to be out of society and in some higher level of care and higher level to protect us, just as though, you know, through the court system, just as there is in an adult world. But it's a very insightful question, and you've lived through quite a bit of it. And I don't know if it's a political, national political phenomena. It's just we can't afford to do it the same way we've done it, and it's not compassionate, and it's not right for society.
Does anyone else on the line have a question? Any other questions in the room?
Is there an electronic form?
Yeah, I can send that.
Where can you find an electronic form for
everyone listening? I'll email it to anybody that's my handout.
The question was, the document that I talked about on highway funding, is if anybody wishes to have that, it's a public document, but Kelsey will email it to you. So if you'd go ahead and email her. And again, any other questions?
Patrick?
So Matt, what's it like sitting in the big chair today?
We got it. We have a question for Patrick. Go ahead, Patrick.
Well, you know, the governor and I have been friends for a long time, and you know, having this opportunity is enjoyable. Quite frankly, I was hoping for more questions, but I enjoy it. And the governor is going to be out of state next week on transportation. He's been invited, and so when he gets to leave, then it's enjoyable for me. But you know, he asked for me to be a partner, and we work on a lot of great things together. And he's a good friend, and he really loves this state as much as all of us do here. But what's really neat is he's going to be in D.C. here next week testifying on this road funding issue in Governor Rounds' committee, in Senator Rounds' committee. He's going to be just talking about, transportation flexibility and what they're doing, and explain what his proposal is here, too. So try to bring some real-world discussions. And obviously, Senator Rounds was governor and was governor for, at the time, Lieutenant Governor Dugard. So it's exciting, and I always appreciate the opportunity. We had the tourism conference last night, so that was fun together, too. Patrick?
Your overall impressions of the first 2 weeks now that we've seen that wrap up. Also, any concerns about the limited number of bills? We've heard that in the public discussion. Also, your take on the new LRC and the structuring that has been going on there, just general overview.
You know, first of all, I think this is the most incredible process in the world. I've lived in countries where governments change over through violence, and I've seen it in the military. I've seen places where I've lived that if you didn't write or cover me the way that I was comfortable with as a leader, that you wouldn't be in the room and your family would be threatened, and a lot of us filtered and censored. And so it is an amazing system that's put together, but it always comes to life to be able to see people, one, who are bright-eyed, passionate about service. They're not doing it for money. They're doing it to be able to say, hey, I want to get involved. And to see that through new legislators' eyes also invigorates legislators who have been here before is very exciting. Secondly, the city of Pierre is an incredible host. A number of people have not spent much time here. And it is an amazing place with great hospitality and also a recognition, a respect for a government that's really driven by the people, only 125 years old. So a little anecdote that I think is very moving for me personally. When I first came into the legislature, there was a classroom in Madison of fourth graders that did Little Legislator. And what they did is the teachers had come up with a curriculum that they would adopt a legislator during session, follow what was going on in session, but also then have their own mock session. Now think about this. The vast majority of people don't understand how a bill becomes law or what's happening in the legislature, and you're helping explain that. And the vast majority of people who are elected won't know the specifics, and so it's brand new. So the first year was a young man who would write me. This was the time when people wrote letters, so it's quite a while ago, instead of an email or anything. And eventually he followed me through my public service path, and he would come every year then. So school was done, but he thought it was so important. And so he would come and he'd bring family. And when I became speaker, he came up and it took the time with him, because that's what happened to me. I was a page. And I didn't come from this. I didn't come from money. I didn't come from politics. That's just not my background. I came from public service, like all of us, to serve others. And he goes out and he graduates. And he's my son's age. And he goes into the Marine Corps. And the last year he came back to Madison, South Dakota. And he, 2 weeks ago, Patrick, raised his hand as a new legislator here by the name of Matthew Woolman. That's what it's about, is telling everybody you have to get involved, because the world is run by the apathetic party. And getting these individuals involved is exciting. As it relates to the numbers, you know, there's quite a few bills that are floating around getting support, and people are starting to know each other. I don't have really an opinion on where we're at numbers, but it'll always be this way, I think, in the future. The other thing, too, is the way that the weeks are structured, with short weeks, especially at the beginning. It's hard to get up ahead of steam. So, you know, if you think of yourself in school and every week is a four-day week, then you've got to jam in quite a bit. And then you go back to your home to do your other work and go to Cracker Barrels, et cetera. And so there's no doubt that there'll be a nice baby tsunami of bills that will come in, and the committee structures are ready. I miss one? Oh, thank you. Yep. The Legislative Research Council is the organization that supports the legislators, and I've had the opportunity to go up there and meet with the staff, and there's really the best example, Patrick, is in the Senate I preside as the president, and the individuals who sit and support me are temporary employees of the state. They're up in the front well there, and they do all of the support and the paperwork for the legislature, in my case the Senate. Two of the four, and almost three, are new. They're new to that position. They essentially have some time and actually come and work up there. And they're the best ones for me to ask, because there were issues in the past, and those issues are gone. And there's a really great cooperative environment, everyone wanting to learn together. And I personally have found Mr. Hancock to be a very impressive man. We've met a number of times. He wants to learn. He works for the legislature, but has asked me a number of procedural questions. I know he and his family enjoy South Dakota, but it's the restructuring and the focus that they have in the team they've put together representing the legislators, I believe, very well. And I've heard that, and then I've also felt it. Thank you.
That's all we have time for. Thank you, everyone, for joining us this morning.
Safe travels, everyone, and thank you for listening in.